You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, where we're talking American League East. It's a race that is really crystallized. The Orioles have somewhat surprisingly emerged with the biggest lead in all of baseball and are very much a contender to have the best record in the American League and home field in the first two rounds. Beyond that, you've got the Yankees and Blue Jays still very much fighting for postseason berths, and the Rays and Red Sox really trying to start figuring out what they need to get done for the remainder of the year and what is going on next year. The Red Sox in particular have been really aggressive about building their 2015 roster. So we'll talk with five MLB.com reporters about the respective clubs that they see on a regular basis. We'll talk about the race. We'll talk about all kinds of stuff over the next hour or so. Thanks, everybody, for listening to MLB.com Extras. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. Britt, you had an interesting item in a game story just this week about the magic number. And Buck Showalter, like a lot of managers, doesn't really want to talk about things that are, you know, more than today or this series. But it's kind of human nature to start looking at that and start noticing that a prize is in sight. How do they manage sort of keeping the hunger and keeping at it and making sure that edge stays sharp for a team that suddenly has a really huge lead and a pretty small magic number?
Yeah, I think you have to kind of start looking at it. Their lead right now in the division is 9.5 games. They're heading into tonight's game only on September 3rd with that magic number at 17. And it's really remarkable when you look at it because I think everyone expected, and rightfully so, for a while, the division to go down to the wire. And the way things have worked out, it's just pretty remarkable. The Orioles have really found a role here. It feels like the Yankees and Toronto have all sorts of issues. And now I heard this stat yesterday, and it's staggering. All of the teams that were leading the division on July 1st no longer are in baseball across the board. So it really shows you that there's been a serious shakeup here in the second half. And the Orioles, to their credit, have really kept their foot on the gas, and they just keep increasing that lead. They're beating up on bad teams. The schedule's been pretty favorable for them the last week or two, and they're doing a real good job at staying in the moment. But I think when you come off of maybe the next week or so, the players are, when you get down to single digits, the players are going to start to get a little bit more excited about that magic number.
Yeah, I mean, and again, not to get too far ahead of things, but there is a balance the manager has to work in September, really any time between youth and experience, but particularly for a team with a big lead, there's this balance between making sure guys are rested, making sure guys don't wear down going into the postseason, and at the same time, like we talk about, not losing an edge. Where do you think Buck Showalter kind of comes on that continuum as far as going all out for best record or whatever, as opposed to maybe making sure guys are healthy and fresh for when the postseason starts?
I don't think the best record really matters all that much to Buck. You got asked about it yesterday, and he kind of really quickly was like, listen, we're just trying to make it to the postseason. And I think that's probably true. I don't think he's going to just let his team kind of coast through the rest of the way. They are going to rest some key guys. A good example of that is J.J. Hardy. Out of the starting lineup yesterday, dealing with a back spasm. Why push it? You need him for the postseason. But this is an interesting situation for Buck to be in because he's done such a good job since he got here of really firing up the Orioles by telling them that they're the underdogs, and no one expects them to do this. Now they're in a different position and that they're the favorites. They've got a sizable lead. So how does he keep the club so consistent? How does he keep them focused? I think a lot of that has to do with the guys in the clubhouse. Nick Markakis, who wasn't here for the 2012 playoff run, he broke his left thumb. Adam Jones is another guy, J.J. Hardy, who I mentioned. These are very calming, stabilizing influences in that clubhouse. I think they're going to be able to keep those guys from getting too excited, from looking too far ahead.
This team, you know, it's interesting. The last time this team was in the postseason, they put up a good fight. But I think there were a lot of people who thought, you know, based on the run differential, based on a lot of things, that I don't think there was much expectation outside the clubhouse of a deep run. Do you think this team is better equipped to go deeper into October than 2 years ago?
Absolutely. I think they're a better team, no question. I really think when you look at the pitching staff, the job that Dave Wallace and Don Cheadle have done as pitching coach and bullpen coach, and obviously has been huge. They call them co-pitching coaches for a reason. These guys work really well in tandem. You've seen a lot of their younger arms step up. Zach Britton, Chris Tillman, Kevin Gaughman, Buck Norris. I mean, these are guys who are pitching well and pitching well consistently. So I think they're better than they were in 2012, when really the whole year they just got by with that bullpen. The starters weren't nearly as consistent or as good.
One piece of good news around this club lately, it's a real short stretch, but there seems like there are some really encouraging signs from Chris Davis lately. Not only getting some hits, getting some home runs, but as we talk now, more walks than strikeouts over the last week and a half, which seems like a really big deal. Is this just a blip, or do you see things maybe really kind of starting to come together for him?
I don't know. I don't think anyone knows, Matthew, because we've had this before. He's had stints, Davis, where he looks like, all right, this is it. He's going to turn it around. Then he goes into another slump. And probably happened four or five times this year. And Chris Davis would be the first to tell you that there's been times where he thought he was going to get hot. It just didn't happen. With that being said, I do agree his at-bats have been better lately. I think he has more singles already in the month of September than he did total in August. So he's been able to finally just concentrate on hitting the ball hard. Don't worry about hitting a home run every at-bat. I think Nelson Cruz heating back up has taken some of that pressure off of Chris Davis, but they need him. If they're going to go far in the playoffs, they're going to need his bat. Everyone knows that the pitching is key when you get to the postseason, but having Chris Davis, because sooner or later, this offense without Manny Machado and Matt Wieters is going to start to feel those effects. So if Davis can be even a shadow of what he was last year for them, it could go a long way. Now, can he do that? I don't know. I know he's made a lot of adjustments lately, really working hard to find himself again, and it's been a struggle, no doubt about it. Now, we're going to know in the next week or two whether or not Chris Davis is on a roll or if he's slumping again, and this was another one of those brief pieces.
Yeah, you mentioned you know, relaxing a little bit and kind of letting hard contact come. And to me, again, the thing that really jumped out was those walk and strikeout numbers. Do you think it's fair to say that that's one of the real key indicators to watch is if a guy has been kind of jumping and trying to do too much, if he's willing to take his walks, willing to lay off some stuff, that's probably one real key indicator that maybe, again, it's a little more than running into a couple of things?
Yeah, I do. I think that obviously if you're walking and you're more patient, you're working those at bats, feeling a little bit more confident, all things that I think Chris Davis is feeling lately. So hopefully this will help him turn around. But like I said, he's gone through these little stretches before several times this season. So it's really, I'm not going to go out there and say, oh, he looks much better, this is it, because I've done it four or five times already this season and hasn't been able to get over that hump.
True. You can ride it every time, of course, because that's the business we're in. But the Orioles made a couple of pretty interesting moves right at the very last moment to get guys in for the postseason, bringing in Alejandro Diaza and Kelly Johnson, guys who have been regulars in the very recent past. Where do these two guys fit for this club, both in September and in October?
Well, both of them could potentially be on the postseason roster. I think they think Diaza is a little bit of an upgrade over David Lowe, at least offensively. He gives you some speed, can steal bases. Kelly Johnson gives him a veteran infielder, a guy who is able to possibly fill in for Manny Machado, and also give them a little insurance. Steve Pierce right now, still sidelined with an abdominal strain. They don't expect him until the Tampa series this weekend. So you're looking at really something uncertain with a guy who's been so hot for them. I mentioned they're down Manny Machado, they're down Matt Wieters. So really just adding that veteran presence, adding a couple more guys who are able to defend and also make their lineup a little bit more balanced. Both guys have shown over their career they can hit right-handed pitching well, and it makes the Orioles lineup a little less left-handed hitting heavy. They're able to hit the lefties and the righties equally, and I think that was big for them to make these two deals, to give them a little bit more depth, foster some competition going into the final month of the season, because they're going to take the best 25 for that postseason roster no matter how long they've been with the team.
Johnson has obviously played a lot of positions. One place he has played a little, you mentioned, is third base. Is there an opportunity for him to play himself into maybe a little more than a part-time role with his ability to play third base for a team that's currently down a third baseman?
Yeah, I think he could get that opportunity. Jimmy Paredes has been there as well. Essentially hasn't looked that great the last couple days, so I don't know what they're going to do long-term. I think they'd like to have Steve Pierce back so they can slide Chris Davis over to third again, because Davis gave them some surprisingly good defense over there.
All right. Well, Brittany Giroli, thanks for taking some time to talk Orioles here on MLB.com Extras.
Talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter Brian Hoke. Brian, it's been an ongoing saga with Masahiro Tanaka. It seems like the most recent thing we've heard is good news. Is this cautionary good news, or is there still maybe some thought that this guy sees a major league game before the year is out?
It's good news in that it's not bad news. It's probably the best way I can put it. He's got some arm fatigue. That's what the Yankees are calling it right now. And basically what you do with that, it's a little bit of a dead arm. You ease off the accelerator, but he's going to throw a bullpen this week. They think he's going to be back on track with that. So there's still a sliver of hope that he can get in a big league game by the end of the year. I would say if I had to bet right now, I'd bet against it, but it's still a possibility. And if the Yankees are playing meaningful games late in September, Tanaka could be able to play a part.
It seems like there's a really significant complication here in that, obviously nobody wants surgery here, but there comes a point, it seems to me, where you kind of have to decide about surgery, because you're no longer talking about just 2015, but at some point you're maybe talking about what it might mean for 2016 as well. How do they kind of walk that line between doing all they can to get him healthy, get him in a game, but also facing that possibility that if surgery happens, the timing does matter at this point?
Yeah, well, I think the Yankees have never pretended that surgery was not an option. I think they've been very cognizant of that since July 8 when he walked off the mound. The way the organization looks at it is they send his results, they send him to four different doctors, four of the best in the world at what they do, and they all said across the board, rehab. Don't have the surgery right now, try rehab first. So when you have four noted doctors saying that, if you don't listen to that, I think it's pretty irresponsible. So, yes, it's still a very real possibility that he could have to have the surgery. I think that history shows that more often than not, guys don't avoid the surgery forever. But if he can get back on the mound without having it, the Yankees owe it to themselves to try that.
How will they walk that line in the short term between caution with a tremendous player and a major asset and the desire to see the postseason this year?
I think it's more than just him. He's not going to come back in and be the white knight that carries him to the postseason. I think he can definitely help, but you're looking at a guy who, in theory, would start once every 5 days, and who knows how many pitches he could even throw on those days. I think that they really need to hit if they're going to get to October. The pitching actually has not been the problem. I feel like we've been talking about it for weeks now. Pitching has been quite good, and I would not have thought that to be the case if you told me they were going to lose 4/5 of their rotation from opening day on. They need to hit. If Tanaka can help, that's terrific for them, but I think that it's going to be bigger than just Tanaka coming back to save the season.
You led me into the next one. I was looking at the lines. Michael Pineda has walked one batter in four games. I mean, he's obviously an asset right now, but what's the level of excitement about him and what he might be in the future if this is what he is in his first year back and as he's dealt with all the physical issues?
Yeah, he's been fantastic, and the Yankees have waited a long time for this. You got a little tease of it in April, and he was quite good in April before the pine tar incident, and then he fell off the radar a bit and vanished for a while, and now he's back. He's kind of picked up where he was in April, and I think the Yankees are finally seeing some returns on that trade. You look at that trade, Jesus Montero to Seattle, and it hasn't really worked out for either team swimmingly to date, and if you had to gauge it right now, the Yankees have won that trade, I think. So he is a top-flight rotation guy when healthy. The problem has been keeping him healthy, and if he can remain in that rotation and keep taking the ball every 5 days, I think this is the real deal. I don't think your eyes are playing tricks on you. I think this is what Michael Pineda is when he's healthy.
And going along with that, we talked a couple of weeks ago, and I asked if maybe the strain was finally showing and if maybe there was reason to worry about Hiroki Kuroda, and basically since the day I asked that question, he's looked like the guy we're all used to seeing being really good. What do you think the story is there? Was that really just a lull and that happens because baseball is hard, or what's the kind of difference now that he's back to what I think people expect to seeing from him?
Well, baseball is hard, but I think he's made adjustments. He knows that he can't approach things the way he did last year because you saw what happened in August and September. So he's backed off a lot between starts. He's kind of saving his bullets and limiting his throwing between starts. This most recent time, he skipped his bullpen completely and went out and pitched a really great game against the Red Sox. So I think that he's realizing that fatigue plus age equals you need to make some changes or you're going to go out there and have a second half like last year. So the Yankees have worked with him on that. Larry Rothschild, the pitching coach, has been very receptive to that. I mean, if he has only a certain number of bullets, they would obviously prefer he waste those on the mound than in the bullpen.
At the back end of the pitching staff, the numbers continue to be absurd for Dellin Betances, and actually in some ways they're getting better. The strikeouts per batter at least are even up here the last couple of weeks. And again, I don't want to be talking too much about 2015 when the Yankees are very much in contention in 2014, but I can't help wondering what that decision is going to look like this winter when they've got to figure something out with Robertson and they've got this guy who potentially could close, but also potentially could be an enormous asset pitching 90 to 100 innings next year. It's probably too soon, but it's hard not to ask how they weigh the back end of their bullpen after this year.
It's a great safety net to have, depending on what happens with Robertson. People have compared Betances' 2014 to Mariano Rivera's 1996, and obviously the outcome of the season might be different this year, but he has been just as good in that role as Rivera was setting up for Wetland. I think that obviously you know what happened with Wetland there. He won a World Series and went off and chased the money and got a big deal in Texas, and Mariano was ready to step in. Now, is it exactly that case here? I can't tell you that. I think that the jump from the seventh and eighth inning to the ninth inning is significant. I don't think that there's any easy way to say it's going to happen, but I think that Betances has shown you he could be capable of being the Yankees closer next year if push came to shove and Robertson did go somewhere else. I think it's amazing that if you look at the numbers, Betances is probably going to wind up leading this team in strikeouts this year, and that's just fantastic for a guy who came into the spring and was fighting for a roster spot, and nobody really knew what was going to happen. He's jumped on the scene in a big way. He's an all-star, and he's got a bright future ahead of him.
Is there any thought that there is real value in keeping him in that role just because of the value of a reliever who can go that many innings, or am I the only lunatic who's obsessed with relievers who can get you 80, 90, 100 innings?
No, I think it's huge, and Girardi has been very comfortable asking Betances for more than three outs, and Betances has responded to that challenge very well. So I think that those you got to get 27 of them, and if you've got one of your best pitchers, a dominant strikeout guy who can come in and get you four or five of them, that's key late in game. So I think there's a lot of value to having Betances in a setup role and bringing back Robertson next year. Obviously, the Yankees have not negotiated with Robertson. He's intent on testing free agency at this point, but I wouldn't rule out the fact that David Robertson could be back next year. The fact that Mariano Rivera retired and nobody's really brought his name up too often, I think that's significant in and of itself, and I don't think that you can just pick somebody up and slot them in there and that would be the case. So I think that if I were the Yankees, I would seriously entertain the idea of keeping Betances and Robertson where they are, because that's one of the big formulas that's helped them get to where they are so far this year.
As the weekend approaches, on Sunday, there's going to be a lot of really happy feelings about Derek Jeter, and we'll get to those in just a sec. But we asked this once. It seems to have come up again here lately. They've shown some willingness to do some other things besides shortstop with him, but is it as clear as it seems from the outside that this guy is going to bat one or two come hell or high water?
Yeah, I mean, Joe Girardi pretty much made that clear this week, saying that they're going to stick with him too. Girardi's explanation was that these are playoff games and Derek Jeter has always been good in playoff games, so he should bat second. Well, the numbers in August did not reflect that. I guess August games are not playoff games, but I think that nobody in the Yankee family wants to see Derek Jeter fail. Nobody wants to see Willie Mays falling down in center field. And he's not at that point. He's not. You've seen a lot of ground balls, a lot of double plays. There's not a lot of extra base power. But there is that professionalism and that belief that he can get it done. And, you know, he is not the only guy, and that's the case that Girardi has made. You look up and down the lineup, there's a lot of guys hitting 230, 240, you know. So I think that when Girardi says it's not fair to single out Derek Jeter, that there is some truth to that. I think that there are other guys here that you can point the finger at. You can point the finger at Brian McCann. You can point the finger at Mark Teixeira, at Carlos Beltran, and say, well, you know, if these guys were hitting two or three-run homers, I know McCann had a big day last night, but if these guys would hit a bunch of three-run homers, it would cover up a lot of the Derek Jeter stuff. But Jeter's always going to be a focal point because of who he is. And, you know, look, there's only a handful of games left here. So I think that if you're clamoring to see Derek Jeter hit seventh or eighth, maybe take a step back and appreciate what you got, because next year you're not going to see it anymore.
Yeah, and let's end this on a happy note. What are you expecting as far as the atmosphere and everything for Sunday's events?
I think it's going to be great. You know, I think you're going to see a lot of familiar faces. It seems like the Yankees have had a lot of these this year with Tino and Paul O'Neill and Joe Torre and Goose Gossage all going into Monument Park. So it's on that aspect of it, it's been a celebratory year. And the Yankees do a great job of celebrating their history, celebrating their present. So I would imagine they will have a red carpet day for Derek Jeter. And then really it's almost like a pregame show for September 25, which is the last Yankee regular season home game. And I think that's going to be something fantastic as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, Brian Hoch, thanks for chatting here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, it's big news around there, and it's also a guy of some personal interest to me since I covered him. What in the world is going on with Colby Rasmus?
Yeah, it's a very interesting situation and kind of a surprising one. Earlier this week, the Blue Jays have, you know, almost essentially kind of cut all ties with Rasmus with a month left in the season. You know, he's had a really, you know, up and down season, and recently it's been a lot more down than it's been up. He's battled some consistency issues this year. I mean, strikeouts have always been a concern for him. But, you know, there was really high expectations for that guy going into this year, especially coming after, you know, a really breakout season last year. And, you know, he just wasn't able to put it together this year. I mean, there's the injury problems earlier this year with the hamstring issue that he had. But, you know, he's been healthy for quite a while now. And, you know, there were some issues that they had inside that clubhouse as well. You know, there was an incident a few weeks ago where he had showed up late and had to be a late scratch for a game. And that was kind of a recurring problem as well with him. So I think there was, you know, some minor clashes with, you know, with the coaching staff, but nothing like that had really been previously reported kind of, you know, with St. Louis that so many people had talked about before. You know, there wasn't anything too big, but I mean, this is a situation now where I think the Blue Jays have really kind of started to turn the page. You know, he's a free agent at the end of the year. They had some success earlier this year when Rasmus was hurt with Kevin Pillar and Anthony Gose as a platoon in center field. And it looks like they've made that decision to go with that platoon moving forward. So it's going to be, the playing time is going to be very sporadic for Rasmus down the stretch. It's going to have to pick his spots here and there.
Is this almost entirely just the best chance to win and make the postseason this year? Is this partly a look ahead to 2015 move? Is it more than just performance? Again, you noted that maybe not everything was perfectly harmonious. I mean, when they make a pretty significant decision like that this late in the season, how do those factors kind of weigh relative to one another?
Yeah, you know, in this case, I think it's a little bit of everything. You know, manager John Gibbons is a big fan of Anthony Gose and what he brings to the table, and I think he also kind of likes what Kevin Pillar brings to the table against left-handers. You know, but Gibbons has been a known guy to really like Gose and what he brings defensively to the table. He is superior in center field to Rasmus. And, you know, so I think there's that component of it. I think Gibbons also likes what Gose kind of brings with his speed at the bottom of that order, makes the Blue Jays lineup a little bit more dynamic. They can play, you know, a little bit more small ball as opposed to relying on the home run like they would more typically do with Rasmus. So there's that performance component, and then there's also the component of, you know, the Blue Jays have a few weeks, and while they're still trying to remain in contention here for a spot in the postseason, I think that they really do want to see what they have in center field with these two guys. You know, they had those few weeks earlier in the season where they were able to platoon. This gives them a few more weeks down the stretch where they can make that evaluation as well and make the determination whether these two guys can hold down the fort next year when Rasmus does leave. Because, you know, it's been known for quite a while that Rasmus probably wouldn't be back, but this development really seals the fate. So it's one of those situations where it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of performance, and it's a little bit of looking to the future.
So is it, I mean, this may even be a dumb question, but at this point it's pretty safe to say he's definitely going to be somewhere else next spring?
Yeah, there's no question about it. You know, he was a guy who originally going into the season, I would have fully expected the Blue Jays to extend a qualifying offer to, you know, just based on his performance last year. It looked like there would have been some value there, and it looked like he would have been in line for a very, very big contract at the end of the season. That's certainly not going to happen now. I think the Blue Jays would be really concerned that he would take that qualifying offer. And so that's not going to happen. That's no longer going to be on the table. And yeah, I mean, this is a relationship that is on the verge of breaking up. It hasn't done so already, and there's no question about it. I think he would like a fresh start somewhere next year, and I think the Blue Jays would like a fresh start with someone else as well.
As that situation has kind of headed in the wrong direction, it does seem like elsewhere in the lineup there are some good things going on. And the main thing that jumps out is the kind of thing, first thing I always look at in the Blue Jays box score, they're hitting the ball out of the park again. Is it safe to say that was maybe the one thing that really needed to happen and needs to continue to happen if this club is going to continue as a significant contender for a postseason spot?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and they talked so much this year about trying to find other ways to generate offense and score runs. And, you know, for the most part, it didn't really happen. I mean, this team is known for hitting home runs, and when they hit home runs, they win games. And you look at what happened, especially during the month of August, where that offense really kind of fell apart for a long period of time. They hit 18 home runs that month. Going into the final day of August until they hit three, they were ranked last in the major leagues in home runs. And that's just something you don't expect from a team that has the type of names that the Blue Jays have. And you compare that to the month of May when they were the best team in baseball. They hit 48 home runs that month. So there's really a large discrepancy. But you know, you look at how they finished the month of August in that final month, and then the success they carried over into the first series in Tampa Bay. And the power has returned. And with this team, it does seem to really come in bunches. It is a little bit cliche, but with this team, it really is true. They you know, when guys in that lineup start hitting home runs, they happen with a lot of frequency. And so the Blue Jays can only hope that this is kind of the start of another serious run, and that they have a little bit left in the tank over the final few weeks, so they can try and make a run and make up some ground against the teams that are ahead of them in the standings.
They are more or less healthy. I mean, they're still without Laurie, but it seems like they're more or less as healthy as they're going to get. Do you think this club, as currently constructed with the guys that are there, is in position to run off a longer stretch of hitting the ball like this, given that it does kind of seem like they've got the guys there who have done some of that production earlier in the year?
Yeah, I think they have one, you know, long last stretch in them. And I've kind of thought that for a little while. I thought it was going to happen earlier than it seems to be happening right now. But, you know, they certainly do. And now the question is whether there's enough time left in the regular season to really make an impact. You look at the amount of games that they're behind for the second wild card. It's not insurmountable, but the issue with them is the amount of teams that are between them and that second wild card. I mean, there's really four teams that are really competing for that spot. So the Blue Jays really have their work cut out for them. But yeah, no, I mean, this team, it's, you know, they'll look back at probably the month of August if they don't end up making the postseason as to really, you know, when the season kind of fell apart on them. And it's unfortunate for the guys in that clubhouse that they didn't turn things around quicker. But in terms of talent on that roster, there's no question that this team should be able to put something good together. You know, I think there's a lot of optimism right now that they can. It's just that whether or not they did it too late is the one thing that remains to be seen.
It seems like there's some interesting stuff going on at the back of the bullpen. We've talked about Casey Jansen before and about how secure his spot is, and it seemed like he was pretty secure. And now it seems like maybe that's not as cut and dried. How are they going forward with the ninth inning? Have there just been a couple of situations where there was another way to go, or is this something where maybe it's not as black and white as Jansen is the closer going forward?
Yeah, and that's one surprising development to me, because, you know, it seemed like, you know, while Jansen was going through some struggles, it seemed like everybody inside that clubhouse was saying the right things. And, you know, whether it was on the record or off the record, it seemed like everybody wanted to make it pretty clear that Jansen was that guy. And just the amount of time he spent with the organization, he kind of didn't think that the Blue Jays were going to make that kind of move until it was really, really necessary. But, you know, they've really kind of focused on Aaron Sanchez of late. And while there's no chance of his future becoming a closer, I mean, he's going to be a starter next year. There's no question about that. That's where they think the true value is. Right now, they're really trying to maximize what they get from him at the back end of that bullpen. So there are going to be times where, you know, he comes in for a two-inning save. They do prefer to use him for two innings at a time. So when they get him up and ready and into a game, if he comes in the eighth inning, the Blue Jays have a lead, three runs or less, then he's probably going to come back out there for the ninth as well. So it's really going to be dictated by the situations. And then there was a game this week in Tampa Bay on Wednesday night where they got him warmed up in the middle innings, in the seventh inning, to come in for a potential setup situation. And then while he didn't get in at that particular time, you know, Tampa Bay ended up cutting the lead, making it a save situation. And because Sanchez had already gotten warmed up, John Gibbons didn't want to have that go to waste because he'd already got him up and warm, and decided to bring him into the game to close that situation as well. So I think you're really kind of almost looking at a closer by committee down there now, where it's a situation where both Jansen and Sanchez are going to get some situations. You know, I certainly wouldn't say that Sanchez is a closer, because there's a lot of restrictions on his use for the remainder of the season. They really don't want to overwork him. And, you know, after he pitched them back-to-back days this week, he's going to get 2 days off. So there are restrictions there. They're not going to use him in every situation, but it's clear that Jansen is no longer the clear-cut closer either. Those two guys are probably going to share that role down the stretch.
All right. Well, Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time here to talk on MLB.com Extras. Talking Tampa Bay Rays. And this is a very special MLB.com Extras, because we have stopped worrying about Adam Berry's arbitration clock, and we have called him up to the podcast, to the show. So MLB.com reporter Adam Berry, based in the Tampa, St. Petersburg area. What is there for this Rays team, which at this point, even the most dedicated apologists have to acknowledge it probably not happening for them this year? What is there left for them to accomplish over these last 3 weeks of the 2014 regular season?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that even the most hardcore apologist is probably giving up on this one. That was pretty obvious when Joe Maddon said they had to go 0-7 Rockies on the rest of the season to have a chance, which it's not really going to happen. But, I mean, there's still plenty left to play for. First and foremost, I think they would like to have a seventh straight winning season, which as of Thursday they would have to go 15-7 to do. I mean, that's obviously, they've been one of the best teams in baseball for so long, sort of against long odds, that is obviously a high priority for them, and it's something to go out on a positive note and look back and say, all right, this was a team that was 18 games under 500, and they still managed to pull out a winning season, which would actually, they would be the first team to ever do that. So they are still playing for a weird little bit of history the rest of the way on a team level. And then, I mean, individually, there's a lot to play for. Evan Longoria has not had a year up to his standards. He would obviously like to establish some confidence heading into next spring. Same goes for guys like Will Myers, Grant Balfour, maybe even Joel Peralta, who got off to a pretty rough start this year. And then I think they would like to see some of their young starters, especially guys like Chris Archer, Jake Odorizzi, finish their first, you know, full season on a strong note, show that they are capable of pitching into September just physically, so that next year they can pitch into September on a higher level.
Is that within the clubhouse? I mean, obviously that's the kind of thing a manager is going to point to, is always going to want to have a goal. Within the clubhouse, is that winning record, is that really a target the guys are aiming for? Is that something they really want, or is that something that a manager says in hopes that his players sort of stay tuned in over the final weeks of the season?
Yeah, I think that's probably more on a managerial and organizational level for the players. I mean, obviously you want to win games. So that's obviously the goal going into every single day. But, I mean, yeah, it's not like they're looking at that and saying, no, you know, we got to go 15-7 to get above 500 so we can say this, that we were the only team to be 18 games under 500 and come back and finish the season with a winning record. No, they're not talking about that on a daily basis, obviously. But I think that is something that would be valuable to them, just to say that they did manage to pull that out.
It's been such a baffling team in a lot of ways. I mean, I was one of the people. I think I picked them to win the American League, never mind the division. And it is hard to figure. Given that, how does the front office look at this? Do they just look at this as baseball is weird and this happened and you kind of go at it again next year? Or do they is there going to be some kind of mandate to really address some things and make some changes to the roster for 2015?
No, honestly, I would say that it is sort of a baseball is weird situation. I think just talking to some people in the front office, you know, everybody runs simulations and things like that for how the season will play out, you know, 100,000 different ways or whatever. And this was basically like less than 1% chance of this happening, especially what happened at the beginning of the year in the first half. So to a certain extent, you just kind of roll it up and say, well, there's no way that can happen again. You know, there's no way James Loney can be what he was in the first half again next year, that Evan Longoria is not going to be Evan Longoria, that Matt Moore, Alex Cobb, all these guys are going to get hurt in this significant time at the beginning of the year. And the other thing is that they came into this season planning for, with like a multi-year plan. This was a multi-year core, and that's evidenced by the fact that they don't have a free agent after this season. They don't have a single free agent heading into the offseason, which is crazy. And it just goes to show that they will go into next year basically with the same team that they hope to have this season, just hoping for better results.
It seems pretty clear that there's no variable more essential, either if they want to get hot here or if they want to be the team they expect to be next year, than Evan Longoria. What, I mean, I've asked Bill about this, and it's just baffling. What is going on with him? Why hitters hit? Why isn't he hitting?
Honestly, that's become my white whale, trying to figure that out, because Evan Longoria has been so consistent in doing what he does, which is hitting and playing good third base defense. And the one thing that I keep coming back to is that he put so much pressure on himself from day one. He reported to spring training talking about how the Rays were going to eat last, you know, how they were going to make it all the way to the end of the season, no gimmicks, no nothing. They were just going to play well and try to make it to the World Series this year. And he talked at the same time about, like, the burden of leadership and, you know, the burden of being the, you know, the franchise player or whatever. And I think when they got off to a poor start as a team, because he actually got off to a decent start individually, I think he took a lot of that on himself. And the one thing that's off with him this season, just in terms of the process, is that he's swinging about, I think it's 6% more than he has in years past, which to me would suggest a player who is trying to make too much happen at the plate. And he's swinging a lot more at the first pitch. And another sort of interesting number that he's got going on is that he's been just about his normal career self with guys on base, but when the bases are empty, he's been a disaster this year, which would also suggest that maybe he's trying to make too much happen when it's just at the plate, when, you know, he's trying to hit that 5-run homer when there's nobody on base. I think that all the numbers sort of line up with the narrative in this case, which is rare that that happens, but I think Longoria has taken the season personally, and that's kind of affected him at the plate this year.
Does that match the eye test to you? Do those numbers look like what you see when you watch him take at bats?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many swings at pitches that, you know, he normally would just let go, and there's a lot of bad swings at pitches that normally he just crushes, especially on the inside part of the plate. And he's looked a little bit more like himself over the past maybe week, 10 days or so, which, again, if you want to talk about the narrative, the pressure is off this team at this point, so maybe he's sort of settling back down. And he's driven in a lot of runs since the All-Star break. That was when he came out and he said, you know, I'm going to stop trying to worry about the pressure and all that and just do what I can to help the team, you know, move a runner over, drive in a run, sack fly, stuff like that. And he has done that from a pure run production standpoint, as in driving in runs since the All-Star break. So I think the first half of the season was just brutal for him in terms of the pressure that he put on himself. And also, I was thinking about this the other day, this has been probably the hardest season for him of his short career in basically every way. I mean, the team, this is the first really bad Rays team that he's been on. This is, you know, he lost, the Rays as a whole lost Don Zimmer, his passing earlier in the season. Evan Longoria was really close to Zim. He lost longtime teammate and very close friend David Price. He struggled personally. This is, I mean, this has just been a rough, weird year for Evan Longoria overall.
It sounds like your expectations, the organization's expectation as well, that given a winter, a breather, a fresh start, is the organization's expectation that this guy is going to be the guy they're used to seeing when next year starts?
Yeah, I would think so. At the beginning of the year, there were also some talks maybe mechanical things were off, and they said they would have been more worried if, you know, if it wasn't mechanical, if it was physical, you know, if he was masking an injury or something like that, because you can fix mechanics, you know, especially over an off season or spring training, or those things just sort of can naturally fix themselves over time. So I think next year he'll be more like himself. Whether or not he's 2013, 2011, whatever, Evan Longoria, I don't know, but I cannot imagine another year like this from him.
The other thing it seems that will have to be the case if they are to be back on top next year is the thing they've sort of always been built about around is the rotation. I think some people thought, and I'm as big a Drew Smyly honk as anybody. I really liked him in Detroit. I really liked the acquisition. But I think he's been even better than Drew Smyly honks anticipated. Is this a real level? Is this a hot streak? What do you think Drew Smyly is going forward? Is this guy a number two starter going forward?
It's a possibility, honestly. I mean, I don't. He's obviously not going to pitch to a sub-2 ERA over a long period of time. So this is just a really incredible run he's on right now. But there are some things that he's done that he didn't necessarily do in Detroit that have maybe made him a little bit more effective. And I also think he's just a smart pitcher, and he's got a lot of weapons, a lot of things that he can do. And the Rays are pretty good as an organization, and especially with pitching coach Jim Hickey, in terms of bringing out those weapons, things that maybe they did not use as well, even though they had them at the previous stops. Like, he's throwing his cutter a lot more to right-handed hitters, and he's been a lot more effective against right-handed hitters, which were basically his kryptonite during his time in Detroit, which is because he was attacking them basically only his changeup, which is not what you would call a great pitch. But if the cutter's working, he'll go to that. If the changeup, it just so happens to be a good day for that, he'll go to that. And when you have two or so weapons that you can use against those right-handed hitters and they don't necessarily know which one's coming, he's going to be a lot more effective, and he has been so far.
All right. Well, Adam Berry, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter, Ian Brown. Ian, you're a little bit like Maverick and Goose in Top Gun. You've seen something that nobody else has seen. You saw Rusney Castillo play recently. What did you see when you went out and saw him actually in person at a baseball field?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, he's got an impressive body. I'll tell you that. He's built like a tank, and you know, it seems like he enjoys being over here in the U.S. And the guy hadn't played in the game in about over a year, and third pitch he rakes in a left field for a single. It's a pretty good sign. He can roll out of bed like that and get a hit after not playing competitive baseball in that long. But I think that, you know, the jury is still out, and we're all still really curious to see exactly what this guy is going to bring to the table.
He's already made a pretty big step up in the system. Now, obviously, that's partly a function of just who's playing. But based on what little they've seen, do the Red Sox have any added confidence that maybe the timetable, a sort of optimistic timetable, is still potentially in effect as far as looking at maybe beginning of next year?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to get him up here, you know, soon. We could see him in Boston in the next week or two. You know, they're just going to let him play out the minor league schedule here. Portland and Pawtucket are in the playoffs right now. He's going to go play with Portland in the playoffs, I think mainly because Jackie Bradley Jr. is still with Pawtucket, so there'll be a little bit of a logjam there in center. And then once the minor league games are done, I would expect him to, you know, play probably about the last couple weeks of the season with the Red Sox. You know, as far as exactly how much he's going to play, that's up in question right now because, you know, Mookie Betts is playing really well right now too.
So that seems pretty striking to me that a guy who had that long of a layoff, they really think can be playing big league games this year, not after a winter of winter ball or whatever, that this is something that could be viable in the very short term?
Yeah, you know, Matthew, I think that given where the team is in the pennant race, they think that this is, you know, what's the harm in just getting him some exposure at the major league level, getting him a taste of, you know, what the highest competition is. So he has an idea of what level he has to play at, you know, going into next year. Is he still probably going to need a few at-bats this winter to get back in baseball rhythm? Yeah, I think he does. But, you know, I think they look at this as a way to get a free look at him, you know, before the year is out. And whether it's a week, whether it's 2 weeks, I think that it's beneficial for the team and for Castillo just to see kind of how he plays, you know, at this level, you know, what his ability is and kind of, you know, maybe what he needs to work on going into next year.
You mentioned Mookie Betts, and you had a game story off the first game at Yankee Stadium. There was a lot to be excited about if you were looking to the future. First, what as Betts has gotten these at-bats and been playing regularly, has he sort of been what's been expected?
Yeah, I mean, I think for 21, I look at Mookie Betts a little bit like I looked at Bogaerts last year. It's just, you know, a guy who's just coming in and doing all this for the first time, it looks so comfortable, you know, on the stage. But, you know, you have to look at it this way, too. The teams don't really know quite how to attack him yet. And I think you saw that with Xander last year. They hadn't really seen, his weaknesses yet. And the key for Ben is going to be once there's a book on him, is he going to then be able to make the adjustment? Because as we've seen with Xander Bogaerts, even if you're very talented like Xander Bogaerts is, it can sometimes take a while to make those adjustments. And, you know, Bogaerts has really had a tough time hitting the sliders this year and hitting some off-speed stuff. So they kind of found some holes in his swing. But, you know, judging by last night, it looks like Xander Bogaerts might finally be starting to figure some things out, too. It's just hard with a 21-year-old player to know exactly when it's going to click for them.
And, you know, Bogaerts, it wasn't just the one game. There were, you know, a couple of good signs in the few days before that. Do you have reason to believe that maybe this is kind of things coming together a little bit, or is this just one of those blips that happens over a long season?
Yeah, you know, I thought all along with Xander Bogaerts, but this guy is just too talented not to hit. He's got too many things going for him. He's got a good eye. He's got great hand-eye coordination. He's got the strength, and it's simply a matter of, you know, seeing more pitches. And I think we all forgot. I think I was guilty of this too. Was just forgetting that, look, this guy was 21 years old and hadn't played a ton in the minor leagues before coming out to the Red Sox last year. It was just kind of natural things in his development that he simply needed to see some more pitching. So, you know, I really expect that he's going to have a pretty good year next year. And yeah, I think that, you know, a strong finish to the season would be great for Xander Bogaerts and for the Red Sox.
Is there, you know, there's been, and again, they haven't really hit the Sam, and I understand that Bogaerts has been more productive than Bradley, but there was pressure on Bradley to produce, to perform, even while he was playing at an elite level defensively. Is there any kind of similar pressure on Bogaerts, or could he have a pretty rough September and still be secure going into next year?
Yeah, I think Bogaerts, the team, is very confident that Xander Bogaerts could be the shortstop next year. I think that they have every intention of going into next year with Bogaerts as a starting shortstop. With Bradley, things are much less clear, especially now that they have Ruzny Castillo and now that they have Mookie Betts. It's just as far as, you know, where he fits. And it seems to me, you know, I think we talked about this before, but the team just doesn't seem thrilled with, you know, the adjustments he's made, you know, on his swing. And even since he's gotten to the minors, they say that reports have been mixed on, you know, some days he carries out the adjustments that they're looking for him to make, and other days it's just not there. And I just, you know, there just seems to be a disconnect right now between Bradley and the Red Sox. So it's hard for me to see right now where he's going to fit in. Maybe he's somebody that you package in a trade this winter. Because, look, I think Jackie Bradley Jr., with his defense, you know, if he could hit you 250, 260, that's still a pretty useful player in the major leagues. I think he does have a future. It's just, I'm not sure right now that future is going to be in Boston.
I'm kind of baffled as to where this is coming from. I mean, you obviously have your ear to the ground there. I don't, but this stuff is not something I recall ever hearing about him, whether it was in college, whether it was in the minors. Is these issues of whether you call it coachability or whatever it is, it seems like it's new this year. Is that correct, or is it just something that never got mentioned before?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the guy has a pretty good he has a pretty good attitude. I think what's happened is, you know, the adjustments they've had and making a swing. I think for whatever reason, he's just not comfortable with those adjustments. And what they really want him to do is cut down on the swing. They feel the swing is too big, and I think he's just having a real hard time feeling comfortable. With this dude, he's probably hit one way his whole life, and now all of a sudden he's trying to, hit a different way, and I just think that it's hard for him. So I don't think that he's trying to be – I don't think he's trying to be disobedient and say, I know, because he's not that type of kid. He's very humble. I just think he's having a hard time making the adjustments because, like I said, he's hit a different way his whole life, and now he's trying to hit a different way. And maybe he's heard too many voices this year and has kind of tried to do too many things at once, and maybe he just needs to step away from it for a little while and come back fresh.
Is there going to be any kind of opportunity for him with the big club before this year is out?
For Bradley, yeah, Bradley's going to be back. I think what he'll do is he'll play with Pawtucket through the end of their playoff run, however long that goes. But the unclear thing with Bradley is just, when he comes back, how much is he going to get a chance to play? Because you're going to be breaking in Ruzy Castillo at that point. You don't really want to slow Mookie Betts down. If he keeps playing the way he has, they've already said Mookie is going to stay in the outfield at least for the rest of this year. And then maybe they'll reevaluate maybe if there's a better fit for him on the club next year. So I just don't know what Bradley's playing time is going to be when he comes back. But, yeah, I do expect the expectation is still that he will spend the last couple weeks of the season in Boston.
Well, they're also kind of cycling through some pitchers and trying to figure out, it seems like, who's got a future, kind of somewhat the same way as they've been doing at some other positions. One guy who continues to get some opportunities who was pretty well regarded as a prospect is Anthony Renato. It's interesting because he's been effective, but some of the peripherals aren't that great. Do you think he's a guy who's ready to be a contributor to a major league rotation?
Yeah, I think the jury's still out on that one because Renato, one thing he's shown is he's a competitor. And even if he hasn't had overpowering, blinding stuff in these games, he has found a way to keep the team in the games where they've won the first three games that he pitched. So I think we still need to see a little more from him to see, is this a guy we can put in our rotation for next year? Right now, I think that Anthony Renato projects as maybe a third or fourth starter. I don't see him as an ace or a number two guy at this point. But I think that, if he keeps developing, I think that he could be a nice third or fourth starter someday. And he could get a chance. I think he'll be in the mix for a spot. I think he'll be one of the guys competing for a spot in spring training next year.
So it is at least fair to say that this is an audition for him. This isn't just they had an opening and he was the guy who was available. This is at least an audition for him.
Yeah. I mean, there's a real method to the madness here. That's what you've seen down the stretch here with Alan Webster, with Ruby De La Rosa, with Anthony Renato, with Brandon Workman to an extent. Let's see which one of these guys impresses us the most going into right, next year. And out of those four, I would say that De La Rosa has definitely been the best, and Renato probably two on that list. And I think that, Webster and Workman have probably fallen out of favor a little bit as guys who can help the Red Sox starting rotation in 2015.
Considering that he's also had some success as a reliever, is it getting toward the time that maybe it's just Workman is a reliever?
Yeah, Matthew. I mean, it looks to me like Workman is a guy who, classic second or third time around the order, teams are starting to hit him. And I think that he could be a pretty good setup guy. We saw that last year, even through the World Series, that he could be, that his stuff can kind of play out of the bullpen. So, I think once they put him back in the rotation this year, they said they didn't want to keep bouncing him back and forth. But I think starting next year, I think, maybe you bring him to camp as a reliever and just let him stay in the bullpen. Because this team is going to need some setup help for next year. I think Workman is a guy who could help them there.
All right, well, Ian Brown, thanks for talking ball here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks everybody for listening.